kpi.org.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Right On Radio. Today, I have Christina Baldwin, the artistic director of the Jungle Theater and the director and co-creator of Dinner for One. Thank you so much for joining us, Christina.
Well, thanks, Emma, for having me.
So can you explain Dinner for One for our audiences here?
You bet. It is inspired by an old vaudeville slapstick sketch comedy piece from the 20s. And it became an iconic film. It's like the film version. There are a couple versions going around. One's like 9 minutes long. One is about 12 minutes long. And it essentially follows a butler who is helping make a dinner party happen for the woman he works for. And it's she's in an advanced age where she has outlived all of her friends. So he is making this party happen, a dinner party, but has been called into service to drink all the cocktails that are served at this party and hijinks ensue. But I first found this piece because it is much beloved little sketch comedy that's played on repeat in Germany and a lot of Scandinavian countries and all over in various pockets of Europe. And various folks, like, this is like a New Year's tradition. Like It's a Wonderful Life sometimes is ubiquitous on American TV or things like that, you know? And so I was touring the American Swedish Institute quite a few years ago now, maybe 5 years ago, with a friend and director at the time, Bruce Karstedt. And one of the theme rooms, and, you know, they're fully decked out for the holidays. It's just such a cool place to visit at the holidays. And they had one room there where they had this old TV and they were playing this sketch comedy on loop. And I couldn't take my eyes off it. And he's like, let's go to the next room. And I'm like, nope, I might want to watch the rest of this thing. And it's this fantastic physical comedian named Freddie Frinton in these. And you can look this up on YouTube and look up Dinner for One, Freddie Frinton. And you see the sketch comedy, and it was absorbing and funny, but I was going through some stuff in my life of having to say goodbye to a relative. And I was like, it's only funny because it's also heartbreaking and true and authentic. So, I saw this whole piece in my head. And so we took this 9 minute sketch and have made an hour long show out of it that involves the slapstick comedy and the celebration at New Year's Eve. And there's it's a two-person piece, but it also has another two people on stage of a violinist and a pianist, and they live accompany the whole time. And it's a lot of fun.
I'm kind of curious because I wasn't really familiar with Dinner for One, and I don't think a lot of Americans knew about it. I did look up like this fun New York Times article that was like 2 or 3-ish years ago. Mm-hmm. And I do think the New York Times, they throw the word Gen Z millennial like a little too often in terms of what was, but it did mention like how the internet is kind of like recapturing just like this very simple 12-minute sketch comedy into like kind of a weird cultural zeitgeist. Did that happen? Because like you found it through the Swedish Institute, but I don't know if there's like a bigger online presence now that's like kind of It definitely it is.
Totally. And that article was so interesting. It came out right as we were closing the first year of the piece. So definitely, I do think it came out of our time of recovering of COVID and losing people, and we're all in this pattern of grief of what we thought our life was, what it is, how do you celebrate, who's around you. It kind of captures this existential feeling of who's how does memory play a part in where we're going and where we came from, but also who's a part of our memories. And so I do think in that, like, I totally agree with you. It's like there's a lot in media this throwing around of Gen Z, millennial, whatever you want to say, but really it is. Culture is what people make of it, and in our culture right now, there's this mass reckoning, I think, of how do you find the joy in chaos, and how are we realistically? And I do think that there's a generation of folks who are rediscovering and remining things that are still pertinent to our experience right now, and that was essentially what we were inspired by. It's not a retelling. It's like we don't reenact this sketch, but we are inspired by the events of this sketch. But it's one of many things where you look back and you get to look through history and you go, oh yeah, there people have gone through some of these things before, and it resonates with me. And then there's a great generation right now that's finding these gems in this pile of media that we've started to amass now, you know? So.
Yeah. What I always thought was kind of interesting, especially they're for like comedy kind of ages not great. And slapstick is one of those things that's like I think of like the Three Stooges and my young I had a younger my younger cousin when he was like 6 or 8 just loved the Three Stooges along with his dad. They both just love like that slapstick kind of comedy. And there is something kind of like timeless, I think, with slapstick that just doesn't seem to age badly at all.
I mean, yeah, when you see
Funny
someone.
appeal too, yeah.
And Jim Lickshidel plays the role of James the Butler in our production, and he's again one of those really gifted physical comedians. That I agree with you. There's a lot of comedy that there's some comedy that relies on current state of affairs, and that is going to change. But there's some comedy that relies on the awkwardness of being human. And I think the comedy that can last is if it's based in something that is eternal, which is how much you care for someone, how much you're willing to risk, and what you can learn and how I mean, like, it, not to make it all full of platitudes, but I do think that there's some comedy that it can last because it's inherently tapping into the stuff that doesn't change. And if it's real, and an audience can smell it when it's fake, and can smell it if you're pandering, and smell it if, like, so you have to keep it based in the truth.
The other kind of question I was really curious about learning about this was it is a 12-minute sketch, like originally like anywhere between like 9 to 18 minute sketch. How did you make that into like a full-fledged hour-long production? What were like the biggest accomplishments, the biggest challenges? Because it's like the premise is pretty simple, but how do you stretch that out into an hour and have the audience kind of not, I don't want to say not get bored, but like keep them entertained, keep them going?
Well, I mean, again, it goes back to like what's the truth of the matter? What is the heartfelt stuff that we didn't want to sacrifice? And again, when I saw this sketch, I like saw this. I saw in my mind's eye the show, the vibe. I knew music needed to be a really big part of it. I knew the performers that I wanted to work with, which for the to be able to conceive it and co-create it, that was with Jim Lickshidel and Sun Me Chomet, and Emily Mettenbrink on violin, who acted as our music director. And so we met a couple, like 6 months before. We started rehearsals, and we did some workshops of exploding, kind of improv-based scenes of what we felt the core of the sketch comedy piece was about. And we knew that the physical humor was one of those like pillars of how to make it work. And so we set the stage of like, I just talked about the stage being a playground and those, the court, you know, the jungle gym is over here and the, you know, the swings are there. And, you find like some basics of like how you simplify where this action happens. And then we just talked about like what was important, but then we just honestly like got in a room and tried to make each other laugh. And if the laugh could continue to happen after we've seen it, you know, time and time again, we knew that was something to build upon. And then with the cornerstone of the, of music, which can help you kind of feel something in a different way and go in another direction, we did that. But it definitely, there were challenges, but I never had any lack of faith for what these people could do, how I felt that the whole piece, because again, it's based in something real of a friendship, really. It's a New Year's Eve friendship story that's very funny and wild. And one of those wild tenets of it is that we incorporate audience prompts, mm-hmm. Improv into the show. So in four different instances during the piece, before the show, the audience is asked to give answers to a couple of questions. And then the characters draw from a bowl of these suggestions and incorporate them into the storytelling of the piece. So there's always an improv element that can vary and morph the show. You'll never see the same show twice.
Well, that's interesting. That's so dynamic.
Yeah. And it's wild. I mean, it's very funny. Like you can hear in the audience when someone's,
piece got it. Yeah. They're like, oh yeah, that was mine.
Yeah. You're like, okay, E5. It's wild. And, you know, I was talking with some folks now that this has become their tradition because this is our third year doing it. And it's something that I think is fun because it is based in comedy, but there still is this heart to it. But it's about the love of friendship and found family in the fact that, you know, you want to celebrate with meaning and be around people you like. And that's essentially all that this butler is trying to do, is like help his friend. Aww. Through this whole thing. So, he has some trouble. So, but the process was fun because I was also in a room with some really trusted colleagues and collaborators who knew the vibe of what we were trying to create and are very, very gifted playwrights and creators in their own stead. So the three of us together with Emilia contributing with music was something where there was so much we actually cut from this.
Oh, God.
to keep it at an hour, because like there's tangents you could go on, and we were like, oh no, that's not this show, let's let's keep this here. So who knows, maybe there will be a Dinner for One part two, The Reckoning.
Oh my gosh. I'm kind of curious, when you mentioned like this is now starting to become people's like smaller holiday traditions, it like a lot of theaters, like I think like Children's has like How the Grinch or something like that.
Yeah.
Is this,
yeah,
like what the idea for like the jungle is, like, hey, we're going to have this as our like our holiday tradition, because it's in the third year, correct?
Yeah, third year. And I'm closing out my fifth year of being artistic director at the jungle, going into my sixth year. And before that, I was working as associate artistic director and a resident director there. And I've been doing holiday shows at the jungle now for 10 years.
Okay.
Where before this, we had a tradition that Sarah Rasmussen, the artistic director before me, had a great tradition of programming. There were pieces called Christmas at Pemberley, which were these Lauren Gunderson plays. There's a trilogy of plays that the jungle helped commission for plays two and three. And so this is, I do think people, especially in Minnesota, it's like you draw inward for the holidays and you want something to do when your family and friends are in town. And a lot of places, there's Christmas Carol, which is a tradition at the Guthrie and the Grinch over at CTC, and different places are finding these great ways to celebrate. And I've been doing a lot of holiday content, even at like Minnesota Orchestra. I was a part of some of their holiday productions. And for me, I think what was significant to us when I started programming Dinner for One was that I was looking for something too that was non-denominational and really got to the core of what it is also in this winter solstice time of memory and the new year and who's around us and who do we miss. And that is what drew me to the story, and that is what has, I think, has resonated with a lot of people, because you can still laugh and have a wild ride and feel like every age in your group is going to find something that speaks to them within this piece, and you're on your merry way making some more memories after that.
Yeah, and for like the third year in its production, are there like any big changes that you anticipate? The improv as well from the audience. Have there been any changes for the productions that you're excited to see for the season, or?
We continue to refine it every year. I mean, this is our third year, and we have a great group of collaborators and designers and folks who make it happen. And so I'm excited to get that back on stage. The most significant change this year is that Sun-Mi Chomet will not be returning to reprise her role as Miss Sophie, but I will be actually stepping in to play Miss Sophie this year, which it's going to be fun, and but it's going to be wild, man. So, and the most the cool significant change on this is that we have another set of actors, Joy Dolo and Tyson Forbes-Lean, who will be playing another Miss Sophie. Oh, hey, Miss Sophie and James, the butler. So we have two teams of Sophie and James that are going to be, it's on our calendar on the website. If you check that out, you can see who's on deck for each performance. But holidays are, it's a robust time, and we wanted to make sure, like, Sunmi couldn't join us because she has family needs calling her away this year. And we wanted to make sure that it was something that, is something that our actor teams get to share in. And so we act as each other's understudies, but we also have some time to be able to restore. So it'll be fun. So those are like the biggest changes this year, and it's going to be a wild ride. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Are you kind of nervous about playing Miss Sophie? Because
Oh yeah, Emma, I
it sounds
Yes, I am, because
like
I am nervous about it. I think also because Sun Mi and who and the character she created, I'm stepping into big shoes. She created a very iconic character in her own way, and so it'll be one of those things where Joy and I both, will have a chance now to kind of figure out what Miss Sophie looks like in other versions. And this has traveled. Last year, this was performed out in Boston at Greater Boston Stage. They did a production of Dinner for One out there. So there are have been multiple iterations of a Miss Sophie and a James. But definitely, I want to make sure it's just fun. And the only nervousness I have is sometimes too, is like wearing those multiple hats of directing and being on stage. Is there's different responsibilities, but we have a great team of support and people who will say, Christina, get off book and be funnier. So
I'm kind of curious about the production, because we got mentioned a little bit earlier in this conversation about music. And I'm curious, how did you collaborate with the musicians? What kind of pieces? Just kind of more the in-depth of the creative process for why music in this in Dinner for One, instead of just like kind of, I don't want to say like slapsticky, kind of like vaudeville, like kind of weird sound effects. Why the instrumentation?
Right.
Else.
Well, I think because I think at the core of this piece, you have to have, for me, it's about, it's only, there's slapstick, but then there's classical music, and those extremes actually help each other. And I think that's how it is for a real human, right? You're laughing to break up, you know, if you have had some tears, like that you, they both exist in the same person and oftentimes in the same, you know, 5 minutes. So, for me, I think extremes help tell a more authentic tale. So, I wanted to ground the slapstick with something that, could deepen the experience. So for me, and again, it's like as soon as I saw this, I like started he I not in a weird way, but I could just I could imagine the feeling of this and the music that was there. And so working with Emilia was fantastic because I could approach her and say, "Ooh, this piece," you know, we would share pieces back and forth, and we'd work on sections when we were doing that workshop time. And I would say, "Okay, this should have this kind of feeling," and we knew the instrumentation was violin and piano, so that kind of tells you some of the bulk of the work. But there's like a Fritz Kreisler piece that kind of bookends this piece called Midnight Bells, that is lovely and sweeping and virtuosic, but there's also, you know, there will be some other pieces in there that you'll kind of recognize and you know, vaguely familiar with that are that contain some meaning. There's a way in which we incorporate Auld Lang Syne into the piece that is lovely. And so I for me, I think because people are all of the things at once, it didn't feel like a far reach to include classical music into this because those things exist together and they can help each other express things that you didn't know were there.
I never really would have thought of that. That's actually a really cool, that's a very good, it's a very interesting take on classical music into like a slapstick, because I always thought of like classical music as like very, as like stuffy environments, like operas, not something like the butler tripping over a rug would ever like kind of, I would never like put those two together.
And I think like we're in a time too where it's like we need to, just as we were talking earlier in the conversation about like that the younger generation mining a lot of the more authentic things that have inherent current resonance. I do think that in America we've kind of been taught to about classical music and opera, and I've had a career in some of those fields, where somehow we have to put our gloves on and handle it with care, like it's this rare antiquity. And the best experiences I've had in those realms of classical music have been when you actually are kind of like getting under the hood and tinkering with it and really feeling, because at one point that music was new to someone. So it's the same principle of what can we draw from it of why this piece speaks to us, what is about it that feels eternal, and also those highs and lows of like if you have something that sounds a little highfalutin, but you have someone tripping over a rug and spilling a drink, it's funny. So
So I just have one final question here before we wrap up. It's kind of standard, but where would you like to see this play go? Would you like to see other theaters do this kind of production, kind of almost adopt it as its little holiday tradition as well?
for
Or
sure. I mean, I think it's a piece that we envision to have a life beyond us. And like I said before, I went to out to Greater Boston Stage, and there were some great performers out there that I had a great chance to see. But also because it has different worlds within it, it has slapstick comedy, it has classical music, it has a great story. It's intimate enough that it can be done in small spaces, but big enough that it could happen in large spaces as well. So we've done work to make this something that could travel to other theaters, become a tradition for other places, but also, maybe classical music venues, maybe if there's folks who are, chamber orchestras or things like that, we have an idea for how that could be. And it's an hour long. It's like the perfect size. You can have dinner with your loved ones and go see a weird show and write your suggestions and go off into the night to make your own memories.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for joining with me today, Christina Baldwin. Just a reminder for folks listening, Dinner for One will be performing at the Jungle Theater from December 6, 2025 to January 4th, 2026. Tickets can be found at thejungletheater.org. Start to make your new holiday tradition for Dinner for One, and then
That's
bring your friends
right.
and family.
That's right, Emma. We want to see you.
Yeah. Thank you so much again.
Thanks, Emma.
KPI. Dot, dot.